This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's continue the conversation, exploring the questions, how should the job performance of Michigan teachers be evaluated? Should there be a statewide common standard used to measure teachers? Those were some of the key questions tackled by the Michigan Council for Educator Effectiveness. The temporary body recently came out with its recommendations for a new statewide teacher evaluation tool. Joining us now is a member of the Council for Educator Effectiveness. She is the principal at Grand Blanc High School. Jennifer Hammond joins us. And we welcome Robert Stevenson, the principal of Donnelly Elementary School in East Lansing. Robert was also one of the top four finalists for National Teacher of the Year in 2010. Robert, very good to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Jennifer, I want to start with you as you were on the council that came up with the recommendations for a teacher evaluation tool. What was the thinking as to why new state standards were needed?
I was a classroom teacher back in the 1990s, so go back a few decades. And at that time, while we have wonderful teacher preparation programs in the state of Michigan, there isn't a common standard or expectation for teaching. I think over time, it was important to define what those expectations are, and so that the entire education community, from K-12 to post-secondary teacher training programs. So I think that was part of the thinking behind this, but also nationwide, there's been a groundswell of interest in this topic, and a few states across the country are a few years ahead of Michigan in terms of also holding educators accountable for student achievement.
So what we've had up until now is just if a district decides to do evaluations, there it is, but you don't have any way of knowing whether, you know, evaluations in South Haven match at all with what's being done in Traverse City?
You are correct. In the past few years, there have been some vendors out in the world that have created some common expectations, but you are correct that most districts chose their own model and had their own expectations for teachers and administrators.
So if the standards that were recommended by the Council for Teacher Effectiveness are adopted, how will things change for the teachers of Michigan?
In our recommendations, there is enough flexibility for local districts to make some of their own decisions. However, the recommendations also provide a framework for having that common understanding and expectation for both professional practice, the practice that happens in the classroom, but also the 50% of the teacher and administrators evaluation that will apply for student achievement and student learning.
And the panel also recommends a teacher be dismissed, what, after 2 years of ineffective ratings?
Correct. And that was a long debated and discussed topic during our meetings. But if you look at some of the rubrics and expectations that have come out of the pilot in the state of Michigan, if you read through those and you see the ineffective descriptors, you will certainly understand why someone in the classroom that is meeting that on a regular basis should be dismissed.
So as we hear, Robert, that the council recommends that half the teacher's evaluation will be based on classroom practices and the other half on student growth, what are your thoughts as someone who's been a teacher and is now an administrator, as you hear these
sure.
recommendations?
Yeah, first, I wanted to commend the work of the council. one of the things that struck me as I read through the report is how evident the goals were that they had set for themselves. They were really aiming for enhanced instruction, improved student achievement, and supportive learning. And that's inherent throughout the report as you read it. As far as the breakdown of the evaluation, I've worked fairly closely with three of the frameworks that had been piloted, and I love that they were piloted by Michigan districts, which is terrific. But the thing that each of these has is some good research as far as the validity of the observation as a tool. And what I mean by that is they've had good success when you have different observers coming in and observing the same teacher, that you would get a similar evaluation. And for educators, for classroom teachers, there is a peace of mind that comes with that, that this isn't just an arbitrary observational tool. The other thing that I like that the council recommended is that the state is requiring that any observer has to be trained so you can increase the validity, and that the state is even supposed to offer trainings annually, which I think is a marvelous thing.
So it sounds like I'm hearing you say, you know, the playing field is leveled.
Well, let me go further.
Okay.
Because it gets complicated.
Mm-hmm, it does.
It really does. And so when you think about the two sides, and this is true for both the administrators and for the classroom teachers, you're really being assessed or evaluated on practice, which is observable. Hmm. And then you are being assessed on the data piece, which is primarily going to be coming from student achievement scores.
Yes.
And this is where it gets really tricky. The tough part is the development of these assessments that, according to the law, have to be valid, have to be reliable, and the state is being charged, rightly so, with developing assessments that will test core content areas. That's going to be language arts, math, science, and social studies. And then the more difficult part are those non-core subjects and developing assessments that will be valid so we can measure student growth. And that is the trickiest part. And my assumption will be that that's where we're going to have the most pushback and the most debate as a state as far as what is a valid assessment and does it really measure the impact that a teacher has had on student learning.
Jennifer, as you and the council members worked on this, what kind of conversations were had and how did you tackle this issue that Robert brings up?
I think Robert is talking about the exams that the state is charged with building in high-volume areas common to most schools, like, say, an art class mm-hmm. or a health class or a PE class. In that situation, we talked a lot about would those exams be required or not. And in the end, we decided that those would be made available to local districts, and it would be their choice to use the exams or not. And in the event that they did choose to use, say, an art exam for a basic level of art, that they would provide the state with data to then determine exactly what Robert is saying. Is it a valid test? And so the more data they get back, then they're able to improve that particular exam. So certainly the core subject areas, the English, math, science, social studies, and so forth, those are required of all of us. But the secondary type of test would be optional.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Hammond, who's the principal at Grand Blanc High School, and she was a member of the Council for Educator Effectiveness, which recently came out with recommendations for a new statewide teacher evaluation tool. And we're also joined by Robert Stevenson, who's the principal of Donnelly Elementary. And one of the issues that always comes up as we have conversations about teacher evaluations based on student performance, and I know you touched on this, Robert, and I want to go into it more with you, is this idea that teachers only have so much time with a student every day, and they can only be so effective in a student's performance. And you've got the home life, you have parents, you have how much they are or not pushed to do homework and how much school is supported at home, all of those factors beyond a teacher's control. Is it fair that that should bring down a teacher's effectiveness rating?
Here again, the council had tried to be cognizant of those things because obviously we know with any given student who comes through the door, 50% of the learning is out of our control. We know that. Mm-hmm. So we try to control what we can control. Now, as far as the assessment piece, and you'll hear a great deal about this, and this is going to be what's referred to as the value-added model. By and large, what this refers to is when we look at assessments that are collected, state assessments that we use, it's a statistic that is run to try to control those variables that you're referring to, the home life, et cetera, to try to isolate what is the true statistical impact of the instruction aside from those other variables. And theoretically, that is absolutely the way to try to accomplish that. the tricky part is researchers will go back and forth and pick sides on whether value-added models really work or not. But it will be interesting to see where the state lands on the value-added model thoughts.
And what are your thoughts, Jennifer?
A few things. First of all, we took it very seriously and actually talked to some national experts on the topic. But some of the things that I think are important to note in terms of our recommendations is we felt as though the value added, while being important, should not encompass 50% of any teacher's evaluation. So in any teacher's or administrator's evaluation, it should be only a quarter of their overall evaluation. And secondly, you're also correct, Robert, in that if you don't account for certain factors that in a value-added model, then there are some teachers that will never be proficient or have the highest mark. So you must take into account poverty. And the other piece of it that most value-added vendors will suggest is in order to be included in a value-added measure for a teacher, the student must be present for 90% of the time in school. And when you say that to a teacher or a principal, that makes a lot of sense.
What have you both heard? I'll start with you because you're on the council, Jennifer. What have you been hearing from teachers since the reports have come out about the recommendations?
I haven't. It's summertime, so
that's
I haven't
true.
Had much reaction. So everything so far has been fairly quiet. One thing that I did hear from teachers that they liked was that the council, instead of recommending four summative categories, highly effective down to ineffective, the council recommended three. And for most teachers, believe it or not, the highly effective category has caused the most angst.
Why?
Why? Because we all come to work and to school wanting to be the very best that we can. And this is a new culture that we're building in our schools. Mm-hmm. And so when someone's come to work for 20 years and everything has been acceptable up to this point, and then now we have this new system and saying, well, you're not highly effective, you're just effective. That's a tough pill to swallow. And so the council talked long and hard about recommending these three because this system is about growth, regardless of whether you are proficient is the term that we recommend, or effective or highly effective. Everyone has room for growth.
Your thoughts, Robert?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. As I understood, it was professional, provisional, and ineffective as the three ratings. And as a new building administrator, fresh from the classroom, one of the things that struck me was the highly effective, effective divisiveness that actually resulted among staff members statewide. It was quite unsettling. But at the same time, there's something that is implied by telling someone they're highly effective. It almost sounds as though you've made it. You've achieved. There's nothing more for you to do. Whereas Dr. Hammond's comment that if we're truly about growth and professional learning, we should call it something else because we want to send a message that educators never stop learning. And we get better and better through professional growth, through collaboration, through constructive criticism and appropriate feedback. And using that highly effective rating sort of pigeonholed some people, I think, into believing that they had finally ascended to that highest level of success. The other thing that I like about the three ratings is the direct connection to certification. Dr. Hammond didn't reference this, but it's highly referenced in the report, and I love it. As it is now, teachers get their certification on a provisional status when they're new, and you can apply for renewal of provisional certificates and then eventually attain your professional certificate. And now they've got it linked that you can't get a professional certificate until you've received 3 years of a professional rating on your evaluation, which to me makes a lot of sense.
We know that the council was very clear that these evaluations shouldn't be used to determine merit pay, but there is a bill in the state legislature right now that would do exactly that. Really, to each of you, as educators, what would you each say to lawmakers who support pay for performance? Jennifer?
I know throughout the country this is being debated as well,
yes.
But I believe there's certainly research out there that shows we're not going to do things differently or work harder for a stipend. We, as human beings, come to our jobs every day and want to do the best that we can. It's not about the money. So I guess, you know, Lansing will make that determination, but I think if you would ask most educators, I think they would agree that a monetary incentive isn't going to change my order of business. I'm going to change because I like to learn and I want to do the best job that I can.
I completely agree with that sentiment. And Dr. Hammond even referenced the research that's out there. In fact, the research cites something completely different, that those areas that have used merit pay tied to evaluation, they're actually finding the reverse effect as far as reducing professional motivation and even quality of performance. And that's troubling. People go into education because we're intrinsically motivated to do so, and we want to help the next generation be the best, most successful group of societal members that we can. You know, you don't really go into education to get rich. It's clearly not the calling.
And I want to just end with getting a sense of what comes next for these, for the recommendations that have been put out now from the Council for Educator Effectiveness. What do we look for now?
Well, the first is the council members are working with a publicity group to do some town hall meetings. So I would encourage everyone to go to the council's website for that schedule. If they'd like any of their questions answered, we would be happy to do that. And then the next step, of course, is the legislature making some determinations on which part of these recommendations they will incorporate into law and into practice. But I think, too, the report also is very clear about taking time to implement the system in the right way. So doing it slowly, but certainly putting the priorities in place so that we can, in the state of Michigan, we can impact student learning and student achievement in the right way.
That was Jennifer Hammond, who's the principal at Grand Blanc High School, who is also a member of the Council for Educator Effectiveness. And she was joined by the principal of Donnelly Elementary School in East Lansing, Robert Stevenson. I know this is the first of many conversations we could have as this unfolds with both of you. And we want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today on Stateside.
It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.